Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of TSULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, we talk about a major birthday for a major American event. May 10th, just 2 weeks away, marks the 150th anniversary of the driving of the Golden Spike. That event at Promontory Summit, Utah, marked the completion of railroad track from one side of the country to the other. To help us understand the event and the history at the site, we turn to Christopher Merritt, who is the Utah State Archaeologist. Christopher, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
And from our regulars at TSULA this month, Chelsea Rose joins us by phone. Mark is out in the field, apparently a little further away from a phone. Chelsea, welcome back.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you. Christopher Merritt, let's start with you. I mean, given the fact that we had one railroad, the Union Pacific building west and the Central Pacific building east, was Utah just lucky to get the final spot?
I think luck and fortune caused us to be in the center, but the Central Pacific was faced with the Sierra Nevadas, which significantly slowed their progress, while the Union Pacific was able to cruise across Nebraska and southern Wyoming. And so everyone kind of thought, even by 1865, that Utah was going to be that center point where the Golden Spike would eventually be driven, but it took a long time and a lot of people to get here.
It did indeed, but you pointed out the big differences in the construction. I mean, when you have to build across, when you're building west from Omaha, it's a different story from building east from Sacramento.
Oh, yeah. Spending two full winters up in the high Sierras dealing with the same kind of snowstorms that the Donner Reed Party ran into a few decades earlier. That was really a really epic feat and required a lot of labor.
Indeed. So why Promontory Summit, Utah, though? Didn't the two railroads lay track side by side for quite a few miles?
As we like to say here, it was the first real big fleecing of the federal government. Both railroads were being paid by the mile for construction, and when President Lincoln signed the 1862 Railway Act, no end was actually selected where the two would join. So until an act of Congress in April of 1869, these two railroads were building for mileage, and so they passed each other for 200 miles in some places, surveying hundreds of miles in advance, figuring like, well, someone's going to stop us eventually, but until then, we'll keep making money.
Wow, this is one of those cases where it truly took an act of Congress to stop something.
Yeah, it was a lot of wrangling, and finally, Promontory Summit was selected, but there was places where the two crews were 100 yards apart, cutting and filling the new grade in eyesight of each other, so it was kind of a real interesting part of American history that it did take an act of Congress to stop it.
Was Promontory Summit chosen because it was a logical place to make a division point or something, or a place to change out engines, given that it is a summit, it sounds like?
Yeah, there was a lot of wrangling for the 5 years before the end of that railroad. Like, some folks wanted the railroad to actually go into Salt Lake, some wanted it to end in Ogden, some wanted it in Corinne, which is about 15 miles east of Promontory Summit. But the summit was picked for that exact reason. It was a high point. They built a roundhouse and some maintenance shops shortly after the Golden Spike, so it was just a logical place to connect the rails.
So May 10th, 1869, the driving of the Golden Spike with all the dignitaries on hand, the famous pictures of basically a whole lot of white men standing around. Chelsea Rose, given your knowledge of the people who built the Transcontinental Railroad, how do you take in the coverage of the ceremony at the time?
Well, you know, they definitely didn't portray the actual people who built it, which were mainly Chinese migrants. And that came back to also, they also did that when they celebrated the 100th anniversary. And of course, a lot of Chinese Americans were pissed off because here they're not being acknowledged or represented as part of this commemoration event. So this year with the 150th, there's been a large effort, international effort, to really focus on the history of the Chinese railroad workers that worked on this rail line and to really forefront that as part of this celebration. So on in 2 weeks, on the actual anniversary, there is a conference that's kind of dedicated to that, where people can go and participate in all these different events that highlight the Chinese role in this momentous American, you know, moment in time.
I was looking at the number just a little while ago. Something like 11,000 Chinese workers were probably involved at some point in building the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the thousands, and I think there's different numbers depending on, you know, what sources you use. And in fact, a lot of the recent scholarship probably has fine-tuned that a little more. But unlike the gold rush and other earlier things that brought in Chinese immigrants to the West, folks were actually brought in large numbers specifically to work on the railroad. And, it was a large coordinated event to get this labor force out there because it was a cheap labor force. And certainly a lot of these folks were exploited pretty brutally, especially when you think about those mountains and blasting through them. And a lot of the work was pretty crazy. And even if you drive in a car through a lot of these same passes through the mountains, it's unbelievable to think what it would take to build this thing back then.
Christopher Merritt, has there been much acknowledgement through Utah's history? It sounds like it happened in Utah, and I mean, obviously a lot of the work also took place in other states, but how well has the state of Utah acknowledged the Chinese workers as part of the crew?
I'd say that we are really doing well as a state. The Chinese Railroad Worker Descendant Association is actually formed out of Salt Lake City, Utah, and it was a couple years ago that it came together. They're doing a five-day conference. I'm going to participate in getting over 220 descendants onto the actual Transcontinental Railroad grade and having them interact with their heritage and their history. And so, you know, about 5 years ago, the Governor Herbert established May 10th as Chinese Railroad Workers' Day. And so I think as a state, we're doing our best to try to recognize a population that was largely ignored in the mainstream histories of the railroad's construction. And if you go back to the 100th anniversary in 1969, they were actually going to have the president of the Chinese Historical Society of America speak, but right as he got up to make his comments, John Wayne showed up. And so they said, nope, we'll have John Wayne speak instead. And so 50 years later, we're trying to right a lot of the wrongs of how the Chinese were historically treated on the railroad's celebration, but then also in the history itself.
Wow. The stories from history about the way we observe history can be really interesting, too. We're talking to Christopher Merritt, who is the Utah State Archaeologist. He's this month's guest on Underground History. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, also with us by phone. You can join us as we talk about the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad and who it affected and how we acknowledge it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Archaeology in the state of Utah then on railroad sites, given that the right-of-way was bypassed not terribly long after 1869. I mean, it seems like there's a fair amount of stuff out there to be explored still, Christopher.
Oh, yeah. And we've been working closely with our partners at the Bureau of Land Management. As you point out, the Transcontinental Railroad grade that went up around the north arm of the Great Salt Lake was in operation from 1869. And in 1900, the railroad decided to cut straight across the Great Salt Lake, and that line's still in use today. It's called the Lucene Cutoff. And so from 1904 until 1943, that northern arm of the Transcontinental, where Promontory Summit's located, became less and less used. And so by 1943, it was so little used that for the war effort, they abandoned the rail, ripped up the ties for making buildings in the local communities, but the actual physical steel rail was either melted down to make munitions or taken to Ogden to be used in a defense depot for interior rail line. So since 1943, the railroad grade has largely been untouched. Today, the BLM, because it reverted back to public domain, the BLM manages 87 contiguous miles of the Transcontinental Railroad as a scenic backcountry byway that the public can go visit anytime they want and drive the actual railroad bed, which sometimes you need to make sure to bring that spare tire because a lot of railroad spikes are left behind.
Wow. What other kinds of things have been found out there? I mean, has there been much exploration by archaeologists?
We're just starting. For about 5 years, we've been working closely to get better and better documentation, but we've been able to find some money through the BLM, through National Park Service, and then even the state of Utah supplying, you know, our labor to go document the town sites and the section camps where these Chinese railroad workers still have a very strong legacy on the ground. One of the communities on this abandoned length called Terrace was actually the fourth largest town in the entire county in 1870, had the third largest Chinatown in Utah. And then by 1904, because the railroad had changed its operations, everything was taken away. And so all that's left on the ground is what we consider, you know, dirt archaeology. But you can still see all the imported material culture that the Chinese brought with them to create a new life in the United States. And so visitors to that landscape can really transport themselves back to the 1870s because it's one of those rare parts of the American West where for about 35 miles, you don't see power lines, cell phone towers, cars, houses. And so you can really be transported back in time and really put yourself in the life experiences of these folks.
That's an interesting phrase you used, imported material culture, and I guess I hadn't thought about it in those terms before. I mean, these are people who are working in some fairly rugged conditions, to put it mildly at times, but they would bring some things with it to make it feel like home. And what kinds of things did they have with them, Christopher?
Oh, yeah, and Chelsea can speak to this, too. The Chinese had a very complex system of organization to bring objects to the United States and Canada and everywhere else that they went in the 19th century. But out on the railroad grade, we're finding porcelain and semi-porcelain bowls that were imported from southern China, stoneware vessels that would have had soy sauce and vinegar and pickled duck eggs. And we found Japanese-style sarabachis for grinding sesame seeds and other grains. We have lots of imported food from Chinese dates that we're seeing the pits. So, you know, everything that you would kind of expect in a Chinese store today in San Francisco or Tacoma or Seattle, you can still find out there in the middle of absolutely nowhere, Utah. But it just shows that strong connection they had to their history, their way of life, and their food.
Chelsea, have you been out to these sites?
Yeah, well, we have. I've been working on the railroad site on the West Coast where we have our own Golden Spike in 1887, the Pacific line that goes up through California and Oregon. But we have a very similar suite of artifacts, and it really reinforces that global network, that this population was really a diaspora across the world. The folks that came from southern China to the West Coast of the United States, they didn't just come here. They went up into Canada, down into Mexico, Australia, New Zealand. It's really a global diaspora. And this project, this anniversary that's coming up in 2 weeks, really spurred archaeologists and historians and all different disciplines to really focus on this story in a collaborative way. And Stanford really led that charge to help people look at this across, like compare sites across the rail line, across other different places where Chinese folks were living. And also we did some work in China as well as part of this to start looking at these global networks to better understand what life was like for these folks in China, where their families were, and how they got over here, and what sort of kinship and you know, like business networks really helped create the material culture and the archaeological sites we're seeing over here.
So did workers come because conditions were, I mean, were they in grinding poverty in China? Is that why most of them came?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there was a lot of factors that really spurred immigration out of China, which was, you know, the Opium Wars, Taiping Rebellion, there was droughts and famines. But also this region had a long history of sending folks out to work in the Malaysian, in Malaysia, Southeast Asia and stuff to send money back in the way of remittances to their families. And so this was kind of part of a larger tradition and an economic strategy that in many cases was very successful for folks. But there was certainly a lot going on in the 19th century that really made life hard in these areas. It was really overpopulated that kind of spurred the large volume of out-migration. But a lot of those folks kept very close ties with their families at home. There was a lot of letters going back and forth, a lot of visits going back and forth. And up until the 1882 Exclusion Act, the folks living in the U.S., working in the railroads or the gold mines or whatever, had really close ties to their families back home. And that changes as part of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which limits immigration and also kind of impacts the way the freedom of movement between the two places, which impacts this population.
Wow, it's interesting to look at the timing then, though. So, you know, we complete the Transcontinental Railroad in May of 1869, 13 years later. Don't come here anymore. We don't want you.
Well, that's not an accident. And in fact, it has to do with that. It's because after this railroad is completed, there's tons of people looking for work. And there's kind of a little bit of a depression at the time in the 1870s. And so the Chinese laborers become a scapegoat for a lot of folks that are out of work. They blame them. It's all their fault, even though they were brought in to help work on these projects. So once this monumental infrastructure project was over, everybody was out on the streets trying to find jobs.
Ah, all right. It really was a case of like, hey, we got too many people who aren't us hanging around. Yeah, it's another part of American history we deal with from time to time. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology back with us for this month's Underground History. We also have with us Christopher Merritt, who's the Utah State Archaeologist, as we talk about the approaching anniversary of the driving of the Golden Spike in 1869 to complete the Transcontinental Railroad 150 years ago as of May 10th. Questions, comments from you, welcome by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Christopher, if the tracks were torn up in 1943 and it's been a 87-mile backcountry byway, at some point there was a Park Service presence restored at that Promontory Summit, wasn't there?
Yeah, so in the 1960s, the Golden Spike National Historic Site, which actually started out as a national monument, was established really to commemorate the driving of the Golden Spike. There's a visitor center, two reconstructed locomotives, and then about another 15 to 20 miles of intact rail bed that you can explore, and there's a couple auto tour loops. So between the Park Service and the BLM, there's over 100 miles of preserved railroad grade and visitor experience in northern Utah that a lot of people just do not take advantage of.
Was it pretty much left alone for the quarter century or so between the tearing up of the tracks and the 100th birthday?
Yeah, this place is about as rural as you can get. And so once that railroad disappeared, the gray just sort of sat and slowly disappeared back into the natural landscape. And so now the BLM, in trying to promote it as a scenic backcountry byway, is trying to almost do, 70, 80 years of deferred maintenance on some of the features out there, because we still have 1870s established trestles. We have them dated to the 1870s, shortly after the completion of the railroad, that they're trying to now maintain for visitor experience and historic preservation. But, in the 1900s, we had 300 guys out there maintaining it 7 days a week. Now the BLM has limited budget and staff trying to do that same kind of maintenance activity. So there's so much to see, but also, it's a big weight on our public land agencies to try to maintain that for the visitor experience.
The trestles you're talking about, are these timber trestles?
Yeah, timber trestles. So we've actually done a little bit of research, and we're finding that a lot of the vertical piles are coming in from the Sierras, made of Doug fir and redwood. We have white pine coming from the Midwest for the deck plates and the railroad ties. And so the BLM has actually completed an inventory, and there's about 70 remaining trestles. Most aren't, grand scale, but, man, that they've been in use for 140 years, standing is pretty impressive.
But that part of Utah, not famous for growing its own trees, which is why these things were hauled in from so far away, right?
Yeah, if you go visit that part of Utah, you're not going to get shade for a while. But, that was the benefit of a railroad, is that they could be cutting trees up in the Sierras and taking it on their newly constructed line right to the front as they're moving. Because put it in perspective, March 27th, 1869, the track laying only entered Utah. And so in a month and a half, they had completed all the way from the west border of Utah all the way to Promontory Summit, plus, extra amount of grade on either side. So these guys were moving quickly, including Utah had the 10-mile feat in one day, where Chinese numbering estimated about 4,000, supported by another 400 to 500 Teamsters and other specialists, built 10 miles of track in one day on April 28, 1869, a feat that's never been matched today.
That is amazing. Chelsea Rose, give us a sense, if you would, about railroading in archaeology, because it seems like railroads are certainly makers of archaeological artifacts on one hand, but also potentially destroyers of prehistoric artifacts on the other hand, as they cut the swath through the landscape.
Yeah, and a lot of railroads modified the landscape in huge ways, cutting through mountains, and the grades can have quite an impact. So there is that exact balance where they're creating a new archaeological site, but they also can really destroy pre-contact era sites. One thing, a lot of the sites going through the mountains, they tend to be in areas that weren't as occupied as much, but I'm sure there's a lot of destruction, which is why anytime they're are any sort of infrastructure improvements to modern railroads or projects that happen in the right-of-ways, archaeologists come in and have a look. I spent the early part of this week poking around near tunnel number 8 on our railroad going through the valley here. looking and some archaeological sites associated with the construction of that railroad. So there's always, but it's still an active rail line. So they're destroying some of that early rail stuff to maintain the active feature so they can continue to use it. So it's a complex type of a feature that archaeologists are very interested in and do our best to try to manage and understand the history and balance all the stakeholders.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that part of it, though, that, you know, the things that an archaeologist or a railroad historian would value would also be getting in the way of modern railroading.
Yeah. No, it's true. And you know, it's a good thing that a lot of these railroads are still able to function. But, they, you know, for example, some of the tunnels, they've had to blast them to raise the roofs on them. So that has an impact on the early construction techniques that you could see in these tunnels, which is pretty cool. But at the same time, if they need them to be taller for safety or to make them usable still, obviously that's got to happen. So, you know, in the best case scenario, those kind of features get recorded and we understand the history of them as much as possible. And then the railroad can continue to use it and update it as they need to so it can stay relevant. And one other thing I wanted to mention, Chris and I are lucky enough to be out in Utah in 2 weeks for the 150th, but they've created this, Chris has created this amazing resource, this map story, so you can look from the comfort of your own home at a lot of this history of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, who was there before it was built, and how it's been used over time, and maybe Chris can talk a little bit about that.
Couple seconds. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. So we spent the last year building a really interactive online map. It's available on our website, history.utah.gov, and you can explore the last 150 years experience, see some photos of what it looks like today.
History.utah.gov. I'll make sure I update our link to you at our site, jeffexchange.org. Christopher Merritt is the Utah State Archaeologist. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, our regular underground history. Thank you both for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange, and best of have a good time on May 10th.